Dennis watched all of this and then delivered himself of but one of the many riddles that he was to propound over the next few days. What can you do with a hole in a stick that you can't do with a stick in a hole? He bellowed across the sandy expanse to where I stood by the fire. The answer involved the idea that a pipe was the vehicle of dimensional travel, and that was what you could do. And thus, the first day of the reversal passed. A reasonable conclusion would have been to suppose that Dennis was toxically schizophrenic and that we should leave the Amazon. What muddied the water considerably was me, because I was comparatively normal except for one thing. I insisted that everything was all right and that Dennis somehow knew exactly what he was doing. It was okay, I insisted. He had done what he set out to do, and now people should try to relax. The reason I felt this way was because it had become very clear that though I had not known anything about how he had done the experiment or the theory, that from the dawn moment when we had piled out of our hammocks to look at the mushroom, something was very bizarre about me. Something had happened to me, it was true. I was in a very strange place. It was because of having close contact with the thing that was like a teacher. It let me know things. I knew things which I couldn't possibly know. Ev had gone through the experiment, but nothing at all had happened to her. The other people seemed very distant. They couldn't understand at all what was happening and preferred to reject us. Everyone behaved oddly. Everyone thought everyone else was crazy. But everyone, relative to their own normal behavior, behaved very oddly. The main thing the teacher said was, "Do not worry. Do not worry, because there is something that you have to get straight about. Your brother will recover. Your companions will take care of him. Do not worry, but listen. You have to get this down." Within hours after the experiment, this started impinging on me. Something that I must figure out. The next morning, Dennis seemed to me slightly more down to earth, but to a degree so slight over the day before that it was a matter of opinion whether he had made any improvement at all. I noticed with interest that while he seemed disoriented and his ideation was in structure as wild and woolly as ever, in content there had been a definite sort of improvement. On the day before, he had seemed to be spread over so vast an amount of space and time that there was little to be identified out of the cosmic churning that he was undergoing. The day before, to find even our own galaxy in his mind had been impossible. On the second day, he awoke within the galaxy, and his visions and fantasies remained within it. Had that been the only instance of his telescoping back into himself, it would not be worth noting. But the fact was that each step of his return to a normal state of mind was accomplished this way. The day after he reached the confines of the galaxy, he entered the solar system, condensing through its planets over several days until he identified only with the Earth, coalescing and condensing through the ecology of his home world. He came to think of himself as all humanity and was able to vividly relive all of its history. Later still, he became the embodiment of all the members of our vast and peculiar Irish family. Again later, he was resolved down into only our immediate family, and from there to the resolution of the dualism involved in the question as to whether he was Dennis or Terence. And finally, and thankfully, he came to rest with the realization that he was Dennis, returned from the edge of the universe of mind, restored and reborn, a shaman in the fullest sense of the word. But that recovery was 20 days into the future from the morning of the 7th of March when we walked to the pasture, just as we had on the morning after the experiment. We walked to the top of a small rise on which grew a young tree. Ama, the Witoto word for brother, had become one of the many new nicknames that Dennis had created for me, Now, as we walked along, we kept our eyes open for mushrooms, as had become our habit, even though all thought of eating mushrooms was now behind us. Dennis strode ahead of me and made his way to this tree. Bending down and parting the grasses at the base of the tree, he pointed to the letters AMA carved in the bark. It was carving at least several years old. The incident was confusing. How had Dennis known the carving was there, and what did it mean anyway? He answered my questions by sweeping his hand toward the dawn horizon and announcing that this was the planet Venus, or the archetypal world of Venus. I had no idea which. These assertions that flew completely in the face of reason were very hard to take and would enkindle in me brief stabs of despair for his state of mind, though most of the time I was able to convince myself that he was improving and returning from the unseen world so vivid to him that he could see nothing else. The idea of the recreation of the scattered self as an alchemical act with immense personal and historical significance was the tack that I used in trying to direct the developing fantasy of my brother. Each morning for several days after the 5th of March, we would walk to the pasture, and I would demand of him the stone. Neither of us perceived these goings on through anything like the light of normal consciousness. The world seemed filled with a near-bending wonder and power that assured me that all things were possible, and that the course of things in the light of this were moving in the right direction. Be amazed at nothing. You are to receive the kingship of the Father. I watched my own understanding of the connections between what we were doing and classical alchemy move by vast intuitive leaps to implicate Gerhard Dorn, Robert Fludd, and Count Michael Meyer. The 36th emblem of Meyer's Atalanta Fugiens is a wonderful visual pun that connects the cube of Stropharia cubensis with the UFO, the hyperobject seen in the sky. It was an image that was constantly before me through those times. John Dee, with his scrying stone and the hieroglyphic monad, is mixed up in the same set of images. Why? Did this circle get deeper into the mystery than did their contemporaries and competition? Nicholas Flamel and his wife, their legendary love affair and their unknown end. Mutus Lieber, a couple working at a furnace. It almost looks as though they are drying mushrooms. Just how sophisticated did alchemy become before Enlightenment science scattered the adepts and rendered their control language inoperable? So that in the pasture each foggy morning, when I demanded of Dennis that he give me the philosopher's stone, it was both pressure upon him to reformulate his consciousness into a unity, and a thing which served as the focus for the transference potential that was so intense as to again and again threaten to engulf us. Not sleeping, being awake constantly, I was in the world of the developing situation at La Cherrera, but also in another world into which my brother had become psychotopologically enmeshed, a world of a dimensional vortex beyond which seemed to be eternity, the land of the dead, all human history, and the UFOs. It was a world whose unseen cybernetic chroniclers spoke telepathically in our minds and revealed that we and all humanity were in the act of becoming once again able to go between these dimensions and our own, to reestablish the eschatological shamanism lost scores of millennia ago. At one point, I picked up a stick, and in the sandy lateritic soil of our living area, I scratched the shorthand symbol for and. I called it the ampersand, and for me, its binding fold in one corner of a quaternary structure was very satisfying. I began to imagine this symbol as the symbol of the hyperdimensional condensation come UFO. I spoke of it as the ampersand for several days. Then I called it the eschatron. This I imagined as a basic unit of time, the combination and resonance among the set of eschatons in the universe, determined which of the possible worlds allowed by physics would actually undergo the formality of occurring. I also imagined that at the intuitively given end of time, all the eschatons would resonate together as a unity and thereby create an ontological transformation of reality. It was at this time that I had the first faint stirrings of thoughts that were to lead eventually to the quantified wave hierarchy of time that is so thoroughly discussed in The Invisible Landscape. These early intuitions bore no resemblance to the final theory, good that they did not, for at that time I would have been completely unable to understand the theory that I was finally to propound. It took years of reading and self-education to keep track of the things that the internal voice was saying. It had a holistic and system-oriented way of approaching things that did seem to be slightly of another order, not enough to be alarming, but enough to again and again remind me that the ideas I was producing were coming fully organized from somewhere else, and I was nothing more than a message decipherer, hard-pressed to keep up with a difficult incoming code. Occasionally I would seem to catch the mechanics of what was happening to us in action, and from such experiences I concluded that whatever it was that was happening, part of it involved all the information that we had ever accumulated down to the most trivial details, so that it seemed that something with overtones of being from outer space or from another dimension, was contacting us and doing it through the peculiar means of using every thought in our heads to lead us into telepathically induced scenarios of extravagant imagining or deep theoretical understanding of things or in-depth scanning of strange times, places, and worlds. The source of this unearthly contact was the Stropharia cubensis and our experiment. Our collective intelligence was not compromised, but what was compromised was the ability to reason, to give a coherent account of what was going on as paradox, coincidence, and general synchronistic strangeness began to asymptotically increase, and into the vacuum left by the collapse of reason rushed a staggering array of exotic intuitions about why things were as they were. On the morning of the third day following the experiment, shortly after breakfast, Dennis announced a new teaching. This was that one could see any point in time by closing one's eyes, visualizing an 8, turning it on its side so as to approximate the sign for infinity, then mentally sliding the two closed rings over each other to form a circle, then shrinking the circle to a dot, and thinking the word please and the target point in space-time. Usually I knew not whence these images came to him. However, this time I was amazed, for I recalled with perfect clarity that 6 weeks before, shortly before I left Vancouver, British Columbia, where I was then living, I had gone to a dentist as part of the standard pre-travel tune-up. While in the waiting room, I had read a several months old journal of some Canadian Education Association. In that journal, which I had not discussed with anyone, was an article, very short, about teaching machines and very young children, the picture this scenario with which the article opened, it may have even been called picture this, was of a child looking at a figure eight on a television screen, rolling it on its side, squeezing it together, etc. It was a bit of media flotsam that my brother, or something working through my brother, was able to lift right out of my mind weeks after I had forgotten it, something able to refashion and use the image in whatever absurd way that it wished. Chapter 14, Looking Backward. 2 months after all of these experiences, around mid-May of 1971, I was moved to try to sum up the particularly bizarre and possibly physics-compromising incidents that I could then recall. Here is what I wrote at that time, a time when I was concerned to refute the idea that schizophrenia was a magic word explaining all that we had undergone. I have almost 2 months' perspective on the events surrounding our experiments at La Chorrera, and though I can clearly recognize that both myself and my brother evinced the classic symptomatology associated with the two generally distinguished categories of process schizophrenia, I am unable to make the assumption that our experiment was therefore nothing but two simultaneously occurring instances of schizophrenia. Rather, and with the full knowledge that such a position argues that I may still be experiencing residual symptoms of the illness, I maintain that we were in fact dealing with an objective phenomenon that, though of a highly peculiar nature, inexorably bound up with psychic processes, does have its basis in the molecular ideas we were in the process of investigating. As empirical evidence of this viewpoint, I mentioned the following points which seem to me to set our experiment outside the realm of mental illness. The suddenness with which the symptoms developed following our actual experiment, within a few minutes after we completed our pre-planned experimental procedures, my brother began to disengage himself from the continuum of shared perceptions, and at this same time, I underwent a willing suspension of disbelief and began to experience the cybernetic unit that we had predicted would be a part of the effect we would cause if we were successful in our attempt to generate a superconducting genetic matrix harmine bond. The integrated or dovetail aspect of our shared disassociation, meaning that, though both of us were experiencing the symptoms of types of schizophrenia, the fantasy, the ideas, and the understanding which we were experiencing were shared, so that while my brother thought of me as the shaman messiah in all manifestations, I perceived him as the condensed mind lens making a return journey across the universe that might have been one logical outcome of our experiment. Each of us alone would have given the clear appearance of being deluded. However, each of us seemed to offer elusive proof of the correctness of the position of the other. I might add that though no one else could understand my brother's peculiar mental processes, I believed I could discern depth and an integrated understanding which seemed to be behind them. But at the same time, I understood that his apparent lack of integration was due to the fact that his thinking was moving backward in some fundamental way. In the same way that a film running in reverse seems to present a spectacle of wild and irrational confusion, yet manages in the end to have things in their proper places, my brother's ideas and physical movements seemed to me to be simply the exact reverse of logical expectations. Knowing that the brain seems to operate on the principle of a hologram, Dennis had speculated before our experiment that he might receive a reverse image of my brain-mind organization for a brief time during the experiment. In listening to his free associations after the reversal, I became certain that this had in fact occurred, but for a much longer time than we had anticipated. In fact, I still believe that our only error throughout this entire experiment and the events following it has been our inability to correctly predict the duration of the process. I believe that our understanding of the mechanisms of the process, aside from its duration, have been correct, though still incomplete. Time is still, in other words, the crux of this matter. At times, my brother's free associations consisted of incidents which I had experienced more than a year previously and more than 10,000 miles from where Dennis was then living, incidents about which I had spoken to no one. Dennis seemed to possess the ability to hear my mind working during the time after the experiment. I illustrate by recalling an incident when I was sitting outside of our jungle hut listening to his free associations, having noticed a few minutes before that his muscles were almost rigid with the enormous physical energy associated with some types of schizophrenia. I worried that he might at some future time resist my efforts to keep him from wandering away on his archetypal errands, which constantly motivated him to try to leave our immediate living area. It occurred to me that with such strength he could easily injure me or perhaps escape. While mulling this disturbing possibility for the first time, I noticed that Dennis had left his hammock and was standing in the doorway of the hut. In a perfect imitation of our father's voice, he consoled me with the spoken thought that Dennis is a good lad and would never do a thing like that. Another incident occurred 7 days after the reversal began. Dennis announced that at 11 o'clock that night, the good shit would appear. This was a reference to a kind of psilocybin-enriched hashish that Dennis claimed he had encountered a few months before leaving the States. This prediction of a material transmutation is not so odd when the alchemical concerns and ideas which led us into this experiment are recalled. After this conversation, Ev and I returned to the forest house for the night, and Dennis stayed at the river house. As was our custom, we smoked a bit of the local marijuana before turning in. During this process, a small fragment fell, still burning from the pipe, and as I picked it up to return it to the pipe, the characteristic odor of Asian hashish was very noticeable. I examined the pipe very carefully, and though no change in the physical appearance of the smoking mixture had occurred, it was now definitely, to my own satisfaction and that of skeptical Ev, behaving exactly like hashish, a drug absolutely unknown in the Amazon in 1971. This phenomenon persisted for about 5 minutes and then slowly faded, leaving us to the rational continuum of normal behavior of materials. It is to be regretted that this transmutation occurred with a substance where any skeptic will be at ease in venting his scorn. We are all familiar with the facile view that potheads can't think straight. But to anyone with in-depth involvement with these two substances, the difference is unmistakable. This experience contained a number of parallels to the Njuli movement among the Luangan people of Borneo, who in the early 1920s promulgated ideas centering around the claim that a piece of resin had suddenly become longer through the influence of a flute played nearby, and that the lengthening of the resin foreshadowed human immortality. Equally absurd and equally inexplicable was an incident that occurred on the morning of the fifth day. Dennis was sitting raving to no one in particular, with the normal camp life going on around him. I was sitting near the cooking fire, sharpening the expedition's buck knife. I listened while Dennis raved, scanning his ramblings for a hint of a message. Suddenly, I stopped my work. "Are you my tailor?" This in a strong English accent. That seemed familiar to me from somewhere. "All these reflections, see? It's me. But where is my tailor, my silly? Look at you. Why, you've got my knickers on." I blushed deeply. I looked at the ground and said nothing. I felt very boxed in. Dennis was imitating the conversation I had had with my little English friend after I had come looking for her and returned with her delirious to my room in Nepal more than a year before. The crazy conversation between she and I that I had never discussed with anyone save her was now booming out over our Amazon clearing in the mad voice of my brother. It was hardly the sort of situation in which I wanted to exalt his prowess as a telepath. I said nothing and waited squirming for his raving to drift off into incoherence, but I was impressed and convinced that he had somehow been able to completely penetrate not only my thought, but my nearly self-forgotten private memories. Most important among the features arguing more than a simple case of simultaneous schizophrenia is the idea model we have created out of the careful observation of things which happen to us. No one can argue that our theory of the hyperspatial nature of hallucinogenic drug states and the experiment we devised to test that theory yielded not only spectacular results, but a wave-particle theory of the nature of time. We took that theory and were able to construe it using the energy maps of the I Ching into a demonstrable idea that within its own terms explicates the nature of time and space. We turned an intuition into an idea model which explains the interconnection of physical and psychological phenomena from the submolecular level to the macrocosmic. Was this simply a creative outburst, or was it part of a close encounter with the UFO enigma? After the first mushroom experience at La Chorrera, we were involved with two ideas in particular. These were the motif of the teacher and the insect motif. Dennis and I could feel the overwhelming presence of some unseen intelligent entity which seemed to be observing and sometimes exerting influence in the situation to keep us moving gently toward a breakthrough. Because of the bizarre nature of the DMT flash, with its seeming stress upon themes alien, insectile, and interstellar, we were led to speculate that the nature of the teacher was somehow that of a diplomat anthropologist come to give us the keys to Galactarian citizenship. We discussed this entity in terms of a giant insect, and through the insect trill of the Amazon jungle at midday, we seemed to be able to discern a deeper harmonic buzz that was the signal keying us to the entity in hyperspace. This sense of the presence of an alien third party was sometimes very intense, most intense from March 5th to 10th, and from there fading off gradually. This image of the insect teacher gave rise to numerous entomological speculations. We thought at the time that the process we were involved with was something like the process of giving birth to a child, but also much like the metamorphosis that occurs in the life cycle of insects, especially Coleoptera and Lepidoptera. We knew that tryptamine was somehow a major part of the solution to the enzymal mysteries surrounding metamorphosis. Recalling certain unconfirmed reports of the grub of a Coleoptera species of eastern Brazil eaten by Indians there for the hallucinatory effect, noting that diffraction of the spectrum of visible light as it occurs in natural phenomena such as rainbows, peacock feathers, certain insects, and the colors that appear on the surfaces of some metals during heating are all persistent motifs within the stages of the alchemical opus. In fact, the cauda pavones, the peacock's tail, is the brief stage which heralds the final whitening.